Welcome to Sports and a Slice of Life. And now, here's your host, Dave Lewis.
How's it going? Thanks for stopping by to check in today. Coming up in just a moment, Bay Area Hall of Fame radio broadcaster Steve Bitker from KCBS. But first, a word from our sponsor. And I didn't become a coffee drinker until the last couple years. Now doing it as a daily jump start, even getting through intermittent fasting, never really a good thing for me, but now it's delicious. It's changed my life since I've been a part of the I'm Up Coffee Company. What separates it from the bigger names you buy off the shelf is the quality. Roasted to order and shipped the same day. You can get ground and whole beans that are single origin and expert blends. I have the Sunrise High Roast Colombian from volcanic loam soil at altitude, which goes perfectly with a couple pieces of dark chocolate. You can order yours online and use the promo code Dave Lewis to get 15% off your first order. The I'm Up Coffee Company, that's imupcoffee.com. Your favorite cup of coffee hasn't been roasted yet. And now, the moment you've been waiting for.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, I've been working on this for the last 30 minutes or so. Steve Bitker, Bay Area Radio Hall of Fame broadcaster from KCBS, book author, has done Major League play-by-play, excellent taste in food and beer, but maybe most important, outstanding husband and father.
And most important, the father of San Francisco Chronicle food writer extraordinaire Janelle Bitker.
I was going to get to that. So how has this impacted her job since she can't go to, you know, restaurants and do the typical food critic thing?
Well, you know, it's amazing what people can do from home. You know, she's doing almost everything from home. Instead of going to restaurants and interviewing people, she's interviewing people over the phone. And the Chronicle photographers are, you know, available around the clock pretty much to go out and take photographs still. And they can do that with social distancing and face masks and the whole thing. So, you know, it still works to the reader. It's no different than it was before. So, you know, she's just killing it. It's great.
Is she getting the food from DoorDash?
She gets some food from DoorDash. You know, there's no special deal involved, but you know, she does take out like the rest of us and has stuff delivered and goes to farmers markets. And you know, I couldn't be prouder of her.
I think you told me that you've been with her on assignment a couple of times, right?
No, actually, I haven't. The only thing that we did was we tried a couple of podcasts that would have been on KCBS in a restaurant talking about food at the restaurant that she had just reviewed. This was when she wrote for the East Bay Express before getting her job at the Chronicle when she was just a restaurant critic. The problem was at both restaurants we tried, after listening back, there was too much ambient sound and it made it difficult to hear the conversation. At one point, Jennifer thought the sound was okay and that we could use it on the air and it was going to run. And then Keith Manconi, who was sort of in charge of the podcast at the station, decided maybe not. And, you know, I can't fault him because I thought it was pretty marginal. If we had tried it a third time, we probably would have, man, I don't know. It's tough to say because no matter where you sit in a restaurant, depending upon acoustics and how many people are in there, it can be pretty loud.
So not to get too technical, but you weren't using directional mics then where you're having it, you know, being pointed right at you so you couldn't get the perimeter sound.
Well, we were trying. I mean, we had one directional mic that we were both sitting very, very close to each other talking into, but it was still picking up so much other sound. So, you know, maybe I needed an engineer because it just wasn't quite enough, which was frustrating because, you know, the content was there, but we just couldn't make it work.
Is there a chance that you go to that again and say, hey, this is a great idea? We'll,
you know what? Jennifer was excited about it to have a regular podcast, you know, father-daughter thing. It would have been fun. But now KCBS has her on the radio so much already now because she's a Chronicle food writer and a source. And so they don't really need the podcast to get Janelle on the air. The only thing they're missing is me with her, but that's not as big a thing. I mean, they use her a lot, you know, I can't keep up with it. It used to be that I'd find out when she was going to be on and I'd listen. And now I'm finding out after the fact or, you know, the other day, Jeff Bell tweeted a tease that they were going to have Janelle on, and I retweeted it before I realized it was a day old. So I missed the interview. So, yeah.
Steve, how long have you been into, you know, fine food and beverage? Because most sports guys, you just think of this, you know, blue collar, beer, hot dog. I mean, you like good stuff. I've had meals with you before, and you've got, you know, some class and refinement to you.
You know what? I think I probably owe it to my brother, because my brother was a chef, a restaurant chef and a pastry chef. And back in the late 80s, do you remember Jeremiah Towers' Amazing Restaurant Stars in San Francisco near City Hall?
I don't.
Oh, it was, you know, one of the great restaurants the city has ever had. And, you know, he was as big a celebrity star chef that there was in the country at the time. And my brother was working at a restaurant in New Haven, Connecticut, and he came out for a visit, a really quick visit, four nights, and he made reservations at eight restaurants that he wanted to try. And I was his company. And these were all really sort of cutting edge at the time, really contemporary interior California cuisine kind of restaurants back in the earliest days of California cuisine with Chez Panisse. And I was along for the ride. And so we went to eight restaurants in 4 days, and the food was incredible at all of them. The experiences were wonderful. And I think that started me on the path to looking at dining out in ways that I hadn't looked at before. And, you know, it's just continued.
I was just thinking back when the Warriors played Cleveland in the NBA Finals, there were a couple of out-of-towners. They were asking about where to go, and you were giving them restaurant recommendations.
Yeah, sure. Why not? But, I mean, my brother got me started, but now my daughter's a food writer, so she is always introducing new restaurants to me. May of last year, when she celebrated, I mean, a family thing has always been with us. If it's your birthday, you get to pick the restaurant, and everybody else picks up the tab. And so for Janelle's birthday in May of last year, she wanted to go to this new restaurant that was run by this woman from Thailand who was the owner and the head chef. And she had a small little place in the Tenderloin that was extremely, you know, highly rated, always on the Chronicle's top 100 and the whole bit. And it wasn't a hole in the wall, but it was just kind of an ordinary nice place inside with great food. And she decided to open up a beautiful spot in downtown San Francisco. It's actually inside one of the big hotels downtown, an outrageously beautiful place with high-end Southeast Asian food. And man, the food was incredible. The place was called Nari, N-A-R-I. I'd love to go back there, you know, back when things, looking ahead, when things ever return to normal, assuming they do. I think the year before she had picked a new contemporary Indian restaurant in downtown San Francisco that was just as good. So I find out about a lot of these places from her, trust me.
That makes me wonder then, with the pandemic, is going out to restaurants maybe one of the things that you miss the most?
Yeah. I mean, it sounds kind of elitist to talk like that, so I don't mean it to be like that. But yeah, it was something that I always look forward to doing. It's funny, Dave, I used to go into downtown San Francisco with my wife, Alice, a lot more, you know, 15, 20, 25 years ago, because the restaurants in the East Bay weren't like they are now. I mean, there's so many great places to go eat in Alameda, Berkeley, Oakland. And so I feel like I don't really need to get into the city. Plus, driving into the city, I've always got to deal with traffic. And, you know, and that can often be a chore. So, but I still miss the experience of dining out, going to good restaurants, having great food, enjoying the ambiance. So I certainly miss that. We do have our favorite restaurants in the East Bay, and we've still, you know, we've been diligent about supporting them.
Mention takeout. A couple names and you and I could get some trade out of it?
We get takeout. We leave really good tips. You know, we've always left about, you know, we usually leave 20% if the service is good. But so many people have said in this time when restaurants are really struggling, you know, if you can, leave 30. So Alice gives me a dirty look, but I do it anyway. But yeah, I mean, if you want great restaurant recommendations, you know, for incredible pasta with wonderful sugo, wonderful sauces, there's Bellotti. Bellotti's got a great restaurant location on College Avenue in Oakland, but they've got a takeout place on Piedmont Avenue in Oakland. And we discovered that going to the takeout place is the way to go. And here's why. You go to the restaurant on College Avenue and you get this wonderful pasta dish with great sauce. By the time you get home, it's 20 minutes later, and it's not as fresh as it was 20 minutes earlier. It's still good, but it's not as good. So instead, you go to the takeout location, you get fresh pasta that's in a showcase glass covering at the counter, and you pick your tortellini or you pick your pappardelle or whatever you want. You can get two bunches. You can put one bunch in each hand. They add up to a pound of pasta, and then you buy a pound of duck sugo, duck sauce, or wild boar sauce or whatever else. You take them home. You boil some water. You put the pasta in the boiling water for a minute, maybe a minute and a half. You take it out al dente. You heat up the sauce, and bingo, you toss it all together, and it's just like it is in the restaurant, maybe without the ambiance, but the food's just as good. So that's one spot that, we really like. And then, you know, there's a couple of others, Farmhouse Thai for Thai food down in Jack London Square. The food there, takeout, is wonderful, just as good as it is dining. And from Jack London to our house, it's, you know, it's only about 10 minutes. So it's a lot better deal. But there's other places too. So those are a couple.
Hey, what's the etiquette? You mentioned the 30% tip. What about tipping for takeout?
Well, you know, you don't get service, but these restaurants are struggling big time. I mean, Tom Colicchio, who's, you know, one of the most nationally renowned chefs in the country, has predicted that 75 to 80% of the restaurants we now know, you know, may not survive this pandemic, since there's no sign of it ending. And in most parts of the country, you still can't dine in at a restaurant, nor should you. And so if you can leave 30% on a takeout, you know, it helps them bottom line. It helps them survive maybe another day, another week, another month. So I think it's the least we can do. I think Congress should help restaurants as a whole. I mean, it's such a big part of our nation. It's a big part of our economy. And if all of these restaurants can't survive, it's really a shame, because you don't know how many new ones are going to go up in their place.
I'm going to have to make a note on that tipping thing, and just in general on the takeout, but especially now during the times that we live in.
Yeah.
Hey, do you feel, Steve, and you're someone that's always spoke your mind. In fact, I see your Twitter feed. You're not afraid to make a comment of some kind. Do you feel sports guys now are more inclined to be more informed on the news, since we don't have as much sports to talk about and we're able to follow, obviously, the pandemic or what's going on with Black Lives Matter?
Hopefully. You know, I'm not sure it's uniform. I mean, I think people who are not so inclined to follow the hard news of the day probably still aren't. But maybe, on the other hand, as you suggest, without the games and with professional sports struggling so badly to restart their seasons, I think it does make a lot of individuals take a more serious look at what's going on, particularly the incredible ineptitude from the federal government, alongside what is true in many states, that, you know, governors have come out looking pretty heroic by comparison. I mean, I've seen several polls nationally. Do you trust the president or your governor more during this pandemic? And the numbers are pretty astonishingly one-sided in favor of governors. Not that every governor has behaved responsibly.
Sure, especially when you talk about Florida, Arizona, Texas.
Yep. Opening up way too early because the president said to open up because he needed his economy to help him get elected, just like he's trying to force all the schools to open. Which, you know, if you have a child or a grandchild, you know, it's the height of irresponsibility for him to do that. He doesn't I mean, he doesn't care about anybody but himself, and at this point only cares about his re-election. But, you know, barring some kind of miracle, I don't see that happening.
What did you think yesterday when he made the push to reopen schools after the CDC issued their guidelines saying, you know, we need to do this, this, and this? He said the guidelines were too tough. I'm going to talk about it. And then Robert Redfield says, we're going to make some new guidelines because the president didn't like them.
Well, that was pretty appalling to hear from the CDC. Not surprising in the slightest to hear what we heard from the president, because that's par for the course. He has had so many opportunities to take the high road and just keeps failing time after time after time, when doing so would help him in his bid to get reelected. You know, he just doesn't see it. And he sees, obviously, that employing the same strategy he went for 4 years ago is the way to do it. Although it seems right now it may secure the most loyal elements of his base, but nothing more this time.
And it seems like the Twitter posts are nothing more than a distraction to avoid the real issues. Like, hey, let's get these restaurants open. Let's get people back in school and let's get our economy right because we're taking care of COVID-19.
And it's the same thing with sports. He wants the games back. He wants the games back. And he's putting pressure in, you know, every segment of society to try to get things back to normal, to try to get the economy on as solid a ground as possible. And if people get sick and die in the process, you know, that's collateral damage to him. There's no question about it. I mean, I was talking to my older daughter today. You know, I've got two grandsons, and talking to her about, you know, what she's heard from her local school district. And, you know, she is as worried about sending her kids to, well, the younger one's too young, but sending the older one to kindergarten. She's as worried about that as any parent is. And, you know, there's no way she is going to send her son to a school in a district that is opening before it should be opening. I mean, it's just insane. And I think even, you know, many parents on the right, parents who may have voted for Trump 4 years ago, if they've got kids, a lot of them are feeling exactly the same.
Despite 99% of the cases being harmless.
That is what he said. That is what he said. Of course, he said a lot of crazy things.
Hey, you're able to, you know what, Steve, that's what I wanted to ask you, is you're able to address this stuff. And I remember coming up as a young broadcaster and, hey, don't talk politics, because all you're going to do is alienate a segment of your audience.
Well,
now you're not doing it, obviously, during your radio broadcast, but we're doing it now and you do it on social media.
Yeah, I can do it as part of my sports broadcast as well. I've just got to be careful. I got to walk a fine line, and whatever I say, it has to be responsible, and I have to be able to back it up. But I've had many, many opportunities in recent weeks and months to do that when you look at how so many states have opened up way too early. And as you said, Arizona and Florida. Remember when we were talking about the major league season taking place in Arizona and Florida at spring training ballparks?
That's crazy.
So, you know, I mean, I remember talking about how insane an idea that was, and I cited statistics showing that the COVID curve in those states was still going up dramatically. And so, as Buster Posey said so beautifully the other day, what are we doing? You know, and I've repeated Buster's line several times since then. I think when he said it, he had no idea that it would be quoted over and over and over again. But at that moment when he was doing his Zoom conference call with reporters, he was just reflecting and thinking aloud with Major League Baseball's insane so far lack of efficiency in its testing program that it had so much time to put together. And he kind of just said in the middle of that, you know, what are we doing? And here we are, the season's supposed to start in 2 weeks, 2 weeks from this interview right now. And if that testing program doesn't improve dramatically in the next week, you know, I think you're going to see more and more players opting out with good reason.
Do you think the 60-game season will come off? They're already announcing, by the way, opening day for next year, April 1st.
You know what? I couldn't believe it. I got both emails from the A's and Giants and deleted them immediately. It's like, this is so irrelevant now.
Yeah, Giants at Seattle, April 1st.
Man, I'm excited.
Oh, what is that?
Yeah, that was strange. That was strange. I don't know whether you asked, do I think it's going to come off? I mean, I just have no idea. Somebody from the Giants or Rays was interviewed the other day and was asked, do you think, I think, in fact, I think, do you think the season is going to start? Do you think all 60 games will be played? Do you think part of the season? And he said, I wouldn't be surprised if it never started. I wouldn't be surprised if we played 60, and I wouldn't be surprised if we played 30. Just illustrating how much is tenuous right now.
What about the fall? Just before we came on, I saw that the Big Ten announced they're scrapping non-conference games, especially for football. So now we get into, you know, one of the big money sports of the fall, and that one kind of on shaky ground right now.
Props to the Ivy League, the first Division I conference to scrap the college football season and all fall sports. I shouldn't say scrap, postpone. You know, they're leaving the door open to those sports next spring. I mean, of all the ideas, this one's the craziest. There's no greater contact team sport than football, and no sport that should not even be contemplated to play than football. And yet, you know, the NFL is proceeding as though the season is going to be played. It's going to start on time. We're going to have two preseason games instead of four. Testing procedures will be in place. Everybody will be fine. I don't see it. You know, in college football, when you talk about the big, like the Southeastern Conference, you know, the conferences that are the biggest in terms of interest and fan-wise in the country, and they're totally committed to playing, but I just don't see it. I think it was Jake's wife, I think her name is Amanda. She's been active on social media, and, you know, she said is it going to take a player, in this case, a baseball player, getting really sick and dying to get Major League Baseball to put the brakes on this? I mean, maybe it will just take one or two or five or six players getting really sick and winding up in the hospital. But I think right now MLB is under this belief that they can pull it off, and maybe they can. Maybe they can. I mean, MLB says they've had, I think it was 58 cases of players testing positive up to this point, although Jake Diekman thinks there's considerably more. And so far, at least, to the best of our knowledge, none of those 58 has been taken seriously ill to require hospital attention. But again, as Diekman said the other day, with the testing so laxed right now, and we're 2 weeks away from the season starting, and let's say the A's are in the middle of a 10-game road trip and they've only been tested once, everybody's in danger, right? You got a clubhouse with 50 people in it. You haven't been tested for days. You haven't had results for days. You got 50 people in the clubhouse. All it takes is one asymptomatic carrier to set it off for everybody. And it might be a player who had engaged in socially irresponsible behavior and catching it that way, or it might be somebody who had followed all the necessary protocols but wound up being an asymptomatic carrier anyway. So it's incredibly risky. If I were a player and I was watching closely how the MLB testing procedure was working or not working up to this point, I'd have one foot out the door. I'd wait until as close to the 23rd as possible But if I weren't entirely comfortable and confident in the program, I'd bail.
I saw a couple of things that the NFL wants to take precautions with. No swapping jerseys after the game. Getting within 6 feet of your opponent as you know, shake their hand afterwards. Like, those two issues would, you know, prevent the spread during a game that, you know, has, you know, tremendous contact over the course of 3 hours.
Yeah, that'll make a big difference, huh?
Insane.
Yes.
We were just addressing your ability to voice your opinion and go public with stuff. What about these folks like DeSean Jackson, Steven Jackson, Kelly Loeffler, who use the social media, in the case of Loeffler writing a letter, to make fools of themselves?
It's been going on a long time. I remember way back at the start of my career, I did a newspaper feature article on, I'll throw two new names at you from the past that you probably don't remember. The first two full-time female sports writers covering professional sports in the Bay Area, Benny Cudaberti and Stephanie Salter. And so, you know, I was interviewing them both about their experiences, you know, being in the locker rooms and dealing with Major League Baseball players and baseball officials and all of that and all the challenges therein. And one thing Stephanie said to me that I never forgot, and she said, ball players aren't paid to be articulate. We are. So it's a mistake to expect or to demand that everybody we interview give us articulate, well thought out quotes. And of course, you carry that to social media, where there's, you know, for a lot of these athletes, there's no filter whatsoever. And things like what DeSean Jackson, you know, I think never being regarded as the brightest bulb in the room over the years, you know, what he ended up posting. Extremely disappointing, embarrassing to the Philadelphia Eagles organization, but not a huge surprise. You know, and Steven Jackson, you know, set out to defend him, used wording that a day later he apologized for. To tell you the truth, Dave, I didn't even mention either one on the air. I mean, I go through so much every afternoon and evening before my next shift and continue going through stuff the next day, but you know, things like that, I mean, they just happen all the time. Some get bigger headlines than others, but I got bigger fish to fry than those guys. Now, Kelly Loeffler is, I'm sorry, Kelly, you mentioned her, the co-owner of the Atlanta Dream. I thought that was more of a legitimate story. I mean, she's a co-owner of a professional basketball team in a league where 80% of the players are Black. And talk about being incredibly ignorant and insensitive to the social dynamics of our current time. And she sends a letter to the commissioner of the WNBA complaining about players being allowed to wear Black Lives Matter and say their names warm-up jerseys when the WNBA season kicks off in Florida, Bradenton, Florida. I believe it's there at the IMG Academy. And that's coming up later this month. And so she asked the commissioner to, you know, rescind the plan and instead suggested that they wear emblems of the American flag on their warm-up jerseys. So needless to say, that suggestion did not go over too well. The players were extremely upset. Some of them are even demanding that she be bought out as a co-owner of the team. But she didn't look too good in this particular case, except, you know, to one of her political heroes, Donald Trump.
I want to play one of the reactions. In fact, this is Candace Parker talking about Loeffler, and she's got to go.
There's no place in the league. There's no place in the WNBA, a league that is the majority minority. And I've said this a number of times. This is a league that is 80% African-American women. We talk about socioeconomic background, gender, women, Black, socioeconomic, talk about sexual orientation. There's no place in this league. And I think we've had a number of people that have stepped forward and listened and have taken initiative and taken action. And we've had those that haven't and continue to make comments and show why we're still in this situation. And so I think a number of players in our league have expressed that there's no place in the league for her.
It's right out of the Trump handbook too, right?
Yeah.
Divide.
Oh, yeah. And what these people have in common and have had in common over the years is that for year after year after year, decade after decade after decade, running from one century to the next, it didn't concern any of them in the slightest when people of color have been systematically oppressed in this country, the black population in particular. I mean, black Americans have complained for years about being mistreated by police. And I think, you know, white America in general kind of rolled their eyes and thought it can't be that bad. And then we've discovered, thanks to body cam videos, that it is that bad and worse than we ever imagined it could be. So once you have that realization, you know, it's time to grow up and change your tune. And those that are open and interested in growing and expanding their horizons do so. And those that live in a vacuum can't do it or won't do it. So, you know, the president won't do it. Kelly Loeffler won't do it. She's a U.S. senator from Georgia, by the way. But so many others are doing it, and it's exciting and it's encouraging to see. And, you know, the protests around the country in almost every case have been very positive and very, very peaceful, as they should be, including two held right here in our town of Alameda, one of which my wife Alice and I attended. And we had a little bit of hesitation just in safety of it. But, you know, we had on our masks and we marched along on the far left side of the street. And whenever it seemed to get a little extra crowded, we moved over to the sidewalk on the far left. So we were always a part of it, but never surrounded by people. And it felt very satisfying. And the only reason we had the second one was because we didn't become aware of its existence until the day after. So we got to pay closer attention.
Wait, what a great example, though, you set for your daughters, you know, about, you know, taking a stand for something.
Well, you know, I got that from my dad. And so, you know, we pass it on to our kids. In fact, our older daughter, Mei Ling, took her older son, Caden, to a similar Black Lives Matter march in San Leandro, where they live. And I was really proud of her. In fact, she took a picture of Caden, who's almost five, holding up a Black Lives Matter placard. And in fact, when Caden was two, he was with Alice and with me at another women's march in Alameda. And he carried a placard, you know, with a holding that I had put together that said, "America, wake up." So I've got photographs of my grandson, age two, with an "America, wake up" sign and 4 3/4 with a "Black Lives Matter" sign. So I think it's awesome.
Generation after generation. So what did you learn from your dad then? What kind of lesson was passed on to you?
Well, you know, my dad was a really international man and a genius. You know, I always looked at my dad as the person that could answer every single question I ever asked him, completely different than I am as a father to my two daughters, where a lot of times my answer is, you know, it's a great question. I really have no idea. But my dad always had an answer. And he grew up in a multicultural, multiracial environment. He was born in Japan. He spent the first 20 years of his life in Shanghai, China, and then Yokohama, Japan. And then he ended up immigrating to the States when he was a young teen. He took two trips throughout much of Europe with my grandfather. And, you know, by the time he got to the States and met my mom when he was a student at Duke and got married, you know, he just, you know, then his two sons and daughter were born, you know, we were just under a lot of influence from our dad, who was an international man with an international approach to life and life's challenges and life's problems and being responsible citizens. And so I can't say enough about, you know, what he passed down to his kids.
Yeah, certainly apple doesn't fall far from the tree in a case like you. So he'd be very proud of you.
Well, he was proud of all of his kids. So, you know, he passed 8 years ago. And, you know, like anyone who's lost a parent, I think of both of them often.
Just to transition to some of your radio stuff, I know that you're often looking for content, you know, during this time. And one of the features you do, I think, is great. You have a guest on and you talk about their favorite books. You do like a top 10 book list. What about for you, maybe at top five or so books either you have read that are related to sports or that are on your to-do list?
Well, yeah, that was interesting. Not something that was planned. I think, you know, Kevin, who does the afternoon sports, who I have incredible respect and affection for, you know, we both went on and talked about our top 10 sports books and our top 10 sports films, you know, just to give us something different to talk about. And in the morning, you know, I tossed it around with Stan and Stan came back with his list and we had fun with it. And it was actually so much fun and we got such good feedback on it that I started inviting, you know, prominent Bay Area sports celebrities to come on. And there was no particular schedule. During certain weeks, you know, we had on somebody different every week. And then now when I look back, I don't think we've had anybody on for the last month. So, you know, we go in and out of it and I'm sure we'll do it again. I don't have my list in front of me now, but I can tell you that.
Yeah, just off the top of your head, you know, maybe five of your favorites and on your to-do list.
My all-time favorite sports book has to be The Boys of Summer by Roger Kahn. And for those listening who don't know, Roger Kahn wrote a book about the Brooklyn Dodgers of the 1950s, a team that was beloved in the Brooklyn area and by Dodger fans all over the country, had some great personalities on that team, an incredibly successful team that seemed to lose to the Yankees in the World Series just every year, finally beat them once, and two other times were beaten out by the Giants, who won the pennant and went to the World Series winning once and losing once. But as beloved as the Dodgers were, these individuals, a lot of them seemed cursed as well. And, you know, some of them died young. Roy Campanella, you know, a horrible accident turned him into a paraplegic when he was in his 40s, just before the Dodgers moved to, or maybe after they moved to Los Angeles. He never played a game in his uniform starting in 58. I know he was honored in 59 when they rolled him out in a wheelchair at a home plate with a crowd that then was a major league record of close to 100,000 fans at the
LA Coliseum.
Yeah. But you had other players who got sick, you know, shortly after their careers ended and passed away. And it was a really, really tight-knit group, you know, Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson, some great characters. And Roger Kahn, such a great writer. And so he wrote about these players, had in-depth interviews with each one. And at the end of it, you know, I read this book, I think, when I was a teenager, and I grew up a, you know, crazy Giants fan. You know, I'm not the same as I used to be. I enjoy baseball, but, you know, I'm not such a hardcore fan of any of the local teams. It's just easier to do my job that way. But when I read it, I was just taken by the fact that I grew reading this book to just love these guys who played for the Dodgers, albeit it was the Brooklyn Dodgers, not the LA Dodgers, but some of them moved on to LA and played with the LA Dodgers as well. But it's just an incredibly warm and moving story. So that was one. Ball Four, the legendary book by the great Jim Boughton. Not the first, maybe. You know, there was a guy named Brosnan. Jim Brosnan. Jim Brosnan was a bespectacled right-handed relief pitcher in the National League back in the 50s and 60s. And before Ball Four, Jim Brosnan wrote two books, The Long Season and Pennant Chase. One of those when he was a member of the Cubs, one of them when he was a member of the Cincinnati Reds. And it was like, you know, he diary. He loved to write. And he, those two books are basically, you know, chronicles of a season written by a guy who was there in the bullpen. And the only difference, in a sense, between those two books and Ball Four was he didn't expose any super embarrassing secrets about the players, you know, about his teammates like Boughton did. But all three of those books made my top 10 list. I just adore every single one of them. I have to tell you this story, Dave. So the book I wrote on the 1958 Giants was published by Sports Publishing, Inc. in Champaign, Illinois. And when Boughton's Ball Four was reprinted in the 1990s, it was published by Sports Publishing, Inc. And one day the phone rang in the newsroom at KCBS, and it was Sports Publishing, Inc. asking me if I would be willing to be Jim Boughton's chauffeur during a trip to San Francisco, because he was doing two book signings in the East Bay. And the publisher told me that when he does book signings, he doesn't like taking taxis because he thinks they're too impersonal. So if there can be a better way, then he was more interested in doing that. So I ended up doing my morning shift at KCBS, picking him up at the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco at, you know, about 10 o'clock in the morning. I got out early and I drove him to Moe's Bookstore in Berkeley. And I think the other one was Cody's, which is pretty close by. And we parked outside Moe's and then did that signing and then went to Cody's by foot. And, you know, and then I drove him back to the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco. And when I picked him up, you know, I was so excited to meet Jim Boughton, but I really didn't know, is Jim Boughton going to be as fun and delightful taking a taxi to the East Bay as he has been, you know, when the lights are on him and the mic is in front of him, or as fun and entertaining as he is when he's writing his books? And, well, I found out pretty because, you know, before we ever got on the Bay Bridge, I said, you know, Jim, I just got to tell you that Ball Four is one of my all-time favorite books. And then he smiled and he was really delighted to hear me say that. So I felt pretty good then. And then I went over two or three anecdotal stories from the book that made me laugh the hardest. And I kid you not, Jim Boughton was laughing as I told the story. And then we were both laughing so hard that, you know, you've got tears coming down your face. We couldn't stop laughing. It was such an incredible experience. And Doug Sovereign asked me to pick up a book for him and have Jim sign it. And so did Mike Sugarman. And so did Stan Bungert. So I got books signed by Jim for those guys. And I got a new copy of Ball Four with, you know, a couple of extra chapters in the back updating his life and everything. And I got him to sign it for me. And, you know, I've had a lot of books signed over the years, but that's one I treasure as much or more than anyone else. Two other books I'll mention just, you know, for the heck of it. One is Havana Heat. And the other is, geez, it happened. I go check my bookshelf, but I don't want to go away from the mic. There was another book, and it's an East Bay author whose name temporarily escapes me. But these are novels that take you back to a time in history, and he weaves a story into a time in history in baseball that really happened. And when you read the book, you wonder how much of this really happened and how much of it is Daryl Brock. That's the author. How much is he creating out of his own imagination? And I asked him that after I interviewed him for one of these two books. And he said, that's for the reader to, you know, to ponder. Didn't give me an exact answer. But one of these books takes place in Cuba back when the New York Giants would do one of their annual barnstorming tours in the spring before the major league season started, when Christy Mathewson was their ace pitcher. And the other one was involved the Cincinnati Red Stockings, the first major league baseball team that actually existed back in the 19th century. And it was written from the perspective of a sports writer who had gotten on a train in the current day, you know, the current era, you know, late 20th century, and he has a seizure on the train platform, and he wakes up and he's back in time in the 1880s or 1870s, traveling with the Cincinnati Red Stockings. And Mark Twain has a prominent role in this book, and it's utterly fascinating. He's an incredible writer. Two books, best baseball novels I ever read, hands down. And two other books. One other book was Loose Balls by Terry Pluto, which was...
I love that book.
Isn't it one of the greatest?
ABA.
ABA, and all the ABA personalities that come to life in that book. Yeah, just amazing.
I wanted to tell you that I'm holding in my hands right now the original San Francisco Giants, and I open up the first page, and you signed it June 6, 1998. That's the first day I met you in person.
Really? And that was in the press box at the Coliseum? No.
No, this is at the Valley Fair Mall in San Jose.
I had two of my best signings at Brentano's bookstore at Valley Fair Mall, and at one of them, Mike McCormick, the stylish, classy, personable left-handed pitcher for the Giants, who won the Cy Young Award in 1967, but was a member of that 58 team. He came out along with Eddie Brasseau, who was a shortstop on that 58 team, and they both signed books and told stories during that book signing, and the place was just mobbed. And man, what a great memory from that. But I had forgotten that that's where I first met you. Did you come the day that those two guys were signing, or the other time?
It must have been the other time, because I only saw you. That was enough. I didn't need any other Giants.
Do you know what book or book series that I discovered during one of my Brentano signings? The Unfortunate Series of Events. You remember those books?
Yeah, I do remember. I never read any of those. But yeah,
what was the guy's name? It was Handler. His last name was Handler, you know? Yeah, because I got there, you know, I didn't want to be late, and I got there 30 or 40 minutes early for the signing. And the manager of the bookstore got me something to drink. And then he had picked up this book. It was like the first book in the series. And he said, "Have you read this book at all? I mean, this is like number one, and there's going to be, you know, over a dozen books in the series. And they're amazing. My kids love them." And so I started reading it while I was sitting waiting for my own book signing, and I got hooked.
Hey, Steve, can older books become audiobooks? Like, could this Giants book be something that's ever heard on Audible?
So you're talking about me narrating it as opposed to the individuals interviewed coming to life through their own words?
No. Well, I mean, you can narrate it, or I could, but just having it as an audiobook, a new book. I'm listening to the John Bolton book right now, which is fantastic. But like an old book like this, could it be an audiobook ever? Is it possible?
I don't see why it couldn't. So I don't know whether it would sell. I don't know whether it even matters. But yeah, sure. I would love to get it reprinted with, you know, some more. You know, it's easier now than it was 20 years ago to find great photographs from any particular era. And so it'd be nice to have it come out again, because Sports Publishing Inc. Went under. You know, they went under. They filed for bankruptcy. And in fact, Jim Boughton called me a couple of more times well after that, those book signings I drove him to, and said, "Are you having trouble getting paid by these guys? Because I am, and it's pissing me off." And I said, "Yeah, you know, they owe me money too, but they, you know, they filed for bankruptcy, went under, and I never got another residual check. So I'm sure I could go to another publisher if I could, you know, find one interested, because it is a pretty esoteric subject. But it'd be fun to do. I remember when Peter McGowan, you know, he wrote the foreword for the book, the late Peter McGowan, the former majority owner of the Giants, who helped save them and keep them in San Francisco in 1993 instead of being in Tampa Bay. Can you believe that? If they'd been in Tampa Bay, they'd still be in the worst mausoleum-like stadium in the major leagues instead of being in the jewel of a ballpark they're in now. Wow. But Peter told me when he got the book, he said he was so excited. He said the stories, the first-person accounts of all these guys who played on the 58 team, about their experiences with the Giants and then their lives in and out of baseball, were so moving. But he said there was one thing that I think could have been better, and I really appreciated his honesty. And he said the photographs could have been better. It could have been on better material, better paper. And I totally agreed. You know, I totally agreed. So you know, that was one thing I, if I got it republished, I'd fix that problem.
$9.24 paperback, $33.99 hardcover, $6.99 Kindle. Do you have a preference on how they buy it?
Those hardcover books are hard to find. I'll tell you that. You know, I ended up getting so many. I mean, the publisher sent me, I mean, I think they sent me a certain number on the house, and then I ended up buying, you know, 50 or 75 more later on, just because there were so many friends I wanted to give them to. And I had three copies of my own that I saved, and that was it. And after my you know, parents had passed, and my brother and I are going through the house, and you know, we're selling stuff that's sellable and just going through photographs and cards and everything. And at the bottom of one drawer in a filing cabinet in my parents' study were about six hardcover copies of this book. I was astonished. I knew that they had bought a bunch of them to give away as gifts, and apparently they had six extras, and they were in the filing cabinet. So I grabbed them and brought them home. So now I've got 9 or 10 instead of three.
So the ones that sell now on Amazon, you don't get any money for that?
No, no. Like I say, the publisher went under. And so I get nothing anymore. You know, I don't get anything anymore. I used to get checks, you know, in the beginning, they were much more significant and sizable than they came to be later on. But I mean, you talk to anybody who's had a book published, and as the years go by, the checks get smaller, but it's still fun to get them. You know, I always look forward to getting a residual check, and then they went under and I didn't get any anymore.
Because I would think over the years with all the sales, I think you did outsell Harry Potter, I think the first year. Sorcerer's Stone. I think you crushed that book.
Is this according to your reliable sources, Dave?
I've done some research prior to going on with you.
Oh my gosh. You know, I think the hardcover copy sold about 10,000 books, which, you know, I never did this with the idea of making money. I did it out of it was a labor of love. And, but it was cool, you know, they initially printed 5,000 and then they all got sold though. So they printed 5,000 more. And then in the, early 2000s, they printed another, I don't know how many thousand soft cover, the ones you alluded to, the soft cover ones, $9 and something.
$9.24.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've got a bunch of those in the closet too. So every now and then somebody says, can I have a copy of your book? I'll pay for it. And I just give them one.
Hey, when do you think you'll be able to go back into the radio station?
You know, great question. First of all, I think the shelter at home started on Monday, March the 16th. And that was Monday the 16th. And I think our first day, I think we started broadcasting from home on that day. In fact, the news director, Jennifer, she called me on Saturday and said, hey, I mean, I knew the day was coming. We were getting closer to it, but I didn't know exactly when it was going to be. But she said, be prepared for working out of the home at some point pretty soon. So she calls me on Saturday and said, I'm going to bring some new equipment over to you on Sunday night, and then you'll go on from home on Monday morning, starting Monday morning. And, you know, the first thing, like people said, wow, you must really love it. You don't have to commute. And that's very, very true. There's a misconception out there that if you cross the San Francisco Bay Bridge before 5 a.m., there can't be any traffic. And that is the furthest thing from the truth. I don't know how it is now, but back pre-pandemic, you know, almost every day was stop and go at some point in both directions, even at the odd hour that I was commuting in and coming back. So I was glad to not have to do that anymore. But I really miss my colleagues, and I really miss the energy in the newsroom. And when I told that to one of my colleagues, few colleagues who still goes into the station, you know, because they still have to have one news anchor manning the board in the studio at all times. And then you've usually got an editor and a producer and maybe a writer production assistant as well. So no more people in the newsroom, I don't think, at once in any shift. But when I would talk to them, you know, they would say, you know, Steve, the energy that you miss isn't there anymore because everybody's gone. So, you know, there's a few people there, but the energy is missing for everybody and everybody misses it. So, yeah, I forgot what your question was, but it is a strange time.
I was asking when you were going to go back.
You know what? Right now, the only thing we know is that the station has notified us that nobody will be allowed back in the station before the 21st of September. And, you know, depending on what the state of the pandemic is in the Bay Area at the time. But I would guess that I will be the last one that's allowed in, because I think I'm, you know, the senior citizen of the whole on-air broadcast crew, unless I'm forgetting somebody. You know, when I joined the station back in 1991, I was one of the youngest. That was 29 years ago.
Is that the criteria for letting folks back in?
Well, I think it is, you know, because if you're over 60, you know, you're part of the at-risk population. And so I think those that are going to be allowed in the last are probably the oldest of us that are out there. So, you know, we'll see what happens. I was thinking about retiring this summer, as you know, but, you know, with the pandemic, everything changes because, you know, what I was looking forward to was retiring and enjoying retirement and traveling, right? I mean, we had a trip to Southeast Asia and Japan planned for this year, and we had a river cruise in Europe planned. And needless to say, neither one of those are taking place. So retirement as it would be now isn't what I had in mind. Plus the fact that, you know, when the stock market crashed earlier this year, you know, we all lost some money. So that's another reason to keep working. So now I'm month to month or day to day, as Hank Greenwald once said, and aren't we all?
Well, the audience gets to be blessed to have you at 15 and 45, you know, for a little while longer. So the audience wins.
Well, I don't know about that, but one thing I get asked by a lot of people is, hey, there's no games. What in the world do you talk about? And, you know, it's interesting. As I mentioned before, every afternoon, starting usually in the late afternoon and into the evening, you know, I'm on my phone and I'm, you know, searching various internet sites and Twitter and all that. And I'm just looking for interesting sports related material. And every single day and night and every single morning, I find stuff. There is no shortage of stuff to talk about. I mean, just today, as I look at my notes, I mean, you had the Major League Soccer tournament, which just started last night, and you had over 100 black players stand. Actually, they knelt and with fists in the air for 8 minutes and 46 seconds on the field. So these are black players playing in the game last night and other black players that weren't playing, but they're all sequestered in Orlando. So they all turned out and they staged this silent protest or tribute for 8 minutes and 46 seconds in honor of George Floyd and in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. And then you mentioned the Kelly Loeffler, her saying that she has no respect whatsoever for the Black Lives Matter movement, and she doesn't want WNBA players honoring them in warm-up jerseys before the game and the outcry that caused. You've got the whole baseball testing problem with the season 2 weeks away. As you mentioned, the Ivy League canceling fall sports, including football, Stanford dropping 11 varsity sports, including men's volleyball. Novak Djokovic claiming he's the victim of a witch hunt. Who does this sound like? You know, because of all the criticism levied against him for hosting that tournament in Serbia, where players tested positive because they weren't taking any social precautions in terms of proper distancing and wearing masks. They were out partying and the whole thing. And Djokovic is defensive about it. And now Nick Kyrgios, of all people, has emerged as the voice of reason within professional tennis because he's been very, very critical of Djokovic and the others who participated in this tournament and whose irresponsible behavior led to several people getting sick with the virus. So there's no shortage of stuff to talk about on a daily basis. Jake Diekman being very outspoken, the A's reliever, about his dissatisfaction with the testing plan, and his wife speaking out as well. So, you know, who needs games? I mean, sports is a fascinating microcosm of our society, and we're at a crossroads in our society right now, a fascinating time in our nation's history. So the sports, if it's not compelling on the air, then I'm failing at my job.
Now you make it come alive, man. I'll be listening tomorrow morning as usual.
Hopefully I won't oversleep.
Hey, I appreciate the time, and be sure to kiss your wife for me and the beautiful little grandkids.
I will. And Dave, it was a pleasure when you gave me the subject matter. I told you that I didn't know whether this would work because I thought I'd be a boring guest, but you know how to host this well.
No, in fact, I ditched most of the topics we're going to talk about. We started rolling about life, and I find that way more compelling than balls and strikes and three-point shots.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. That's what makes sports so fascinating right now.
You're the best, man.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks to our special guest, Steve Bitker from KCBS. The executive producer is Hunter Lewis. You can subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, YouTube, iHeartRadio, and Apple Podcasts. We appreciate your positive feedback. 5-star reviews certainly help out a lot. Thanks again to the I'm Up Coffee Company, and thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next time.